We've been hearing from Jim DeLange about his congregation in San Francisco and about how in a diverse community like that, in a congregation that has 75% gay and lesbian people, and their struggle and their joys in being a community and family that connects with diverse members. And so when the teaching staff gathered on Monday night, we all talked together about how that works, and we realized that often when we talk about cultures coming together, we talk about, you know, A culture over here and B culture over here and C, and we talk about, you know, them getting to know one another and sort of living in harmony, sort of outside the bounds of how we think of normal family. Then we started thinking, well, there are a lot of, in most families.
There's what?
In most families, there's also huge diversity. Whether it is, say, a hearing person in a deaf family, or people who have different, who have adopted children, for example, that are of a different race than the parents. There are multitudinous ways, sometimes chronic illness, or births, or accidents at birth, or other kinds of things will allow for there a necessary, thank you, I got the right category, necessary diversity in the family that the family has to deal with. And as we all know, some families do it really well, and some families have a lot of trouble. Also in our conversation, Paul Rohde mentioned at one point how his three daughters, which are nice, you know, are kind of the norm for Holden Village. They're blonde from Minnesota. You know, I mean, what can you do?
And they're all
female. And their dad's a pastor, and their mother's a musician. I mean, it's sort of like everything we think of as normative. But he was sharing about how just as parents understand how each one of their children is very different. So we thought that talking about the kind of that all of our families have diversity within them might be interesting. Let me introduce who's here. I talked about Paul and why he's here. He's here tonight because he's a father. And Tom is doing wonderful sessions on intercultural studies. He's a mediator and teaches at the University of Minnesota. And today in his session, I was doing what teaching staff coordinators do at Holden, which is, I call it, session cruising. Yeah, go to half hour of one and half an hour of another one. But he was talking about the difference between assimilation and amalgamation. Big difference. Amalgamation is much harder than assimilation. He was saying assimilation is the person in power goes, okay, we do it my way and you all just join in, right? Amalgamation means we all have to be there together with whoever we are. That's how I understood what you were saying. And Jane's here because she's been talking about parenting all week, and has been talking about the core of our theology as Christians, particularly as Lutheran Christians, and how faith influences how we see and understand our relationships. Barb is a member of a wonderful congregation, Roman Catholic, in Minneapolis, that is about as diverse as a congregational family can get. So that's why we're all here. That's a longer introduction than usual, but I wanted to try and focus the theme a little bit for you. And you're all here, no doubt, with your own stories from your own family. So we'll have each person briefly, like 3 minutes. I'll time you, Jane.
Yeah,
I'll punch you. No, I have to tease Jane.
Far more eloquent about Episcopalian.
So, we'll give you each, you know, 3 or 4 minutes to say whatever you think of, and then we'll open it up for conversation. Here's some things about forums at Holden. We'll end at 9:30 for people who have to leave. If there are people who then wish to continue the conversation with each other or with any of the panelists, you're free to do that. Holden tries to create a safe place to express one's ideas and opinions on a topic. We encourage lively conversation in a spirit of love, grace, and good manners. And along those lines, because we have at least one person here tonight who is deaf, we ask that when you're in conversation with each other, that before you speak, you raise your hand. Not so much to be called on, but so that the interpreters know where who's speaking. And also, remember there's a lag time, so try not to interrupt each other. Yeah, because it's, you need to come to the end of one thought before the next person leaps in. Also, we all try to make sure that everybody who wants to speak in the context of the hour has an opportunity to, which means I had better quit this soon. And that every voice in this forum is, of course, valued and honored as any other voice. So, let's be random here. Tom, do you want to start?
Random. First of all, I
didn't even, never mind.
Here I am, a thousand or so miles away from home, sitting on a panel that's supposed to be diverse, and I still find myself with three Minnesotans on this side, and two of us are Roman Catholic, so I mean, it's great. Appreciate this opportunity. This is a real benefit. I didn't have the opportunity to do this last time when I was here 2 years ago. Diversity in families. I have a son and I've got a daughter and I've got a stepson as well. My two children, my son and daughter are as diverse as you possibly can have. And so I have a sense of diversity from a kind of a personal point of view in terms of how you deal with individuals within your family. I was married again 7 years ago to my wife Colette, who is here.
I'm diverse.
And she's and the first thing that struck me when the question of the diversity came up and we talked and we thought about it about family is that I have to sit on panels like this to remind myself that other people see that there is diversity between my wife and I. I don't see her as diverse until somebody else goes ahead and calls that attention to me. And I simply want to raise that point because this whole issue of diversity is from my point of view and the type of work that I find myself drawn to, it's not a fight, but it's kind of an ongoing discussion regarding what's the source of the question of diversity? Because we keep making the mistake that, because I see things or I assume things because of the color or the dimension or the size or whatnot or the tag that some social tag that somebody gives, that we assume diversity exists simply because I see things as different from one another. So diversity meaning difference. And the communities that I see that work the best seem to do something really kind of peculiar in that in one respect they are diverse because there are differences, but when you penetrate that group and you're on the inside, that whole concept of diversity no longer works. that the differences are there, but they do not seem to have the same meaning, the same context as when you step outside of the group. And so the one point I would simply want to make and throw out for people to kind of chew on hopefully a little bit later is that when we say diversity, whether we create a panel and say it's the panel on diversity or whatnot, it never makes sense until you can find out what's the position that person holds who has defined it as diverse. And until you discover what that position is, you're never quite sure what you have. So diversity means, first of all, I need to understand the origin of the definition. I'll stop right there.
I'd like to clarify the diversity of the panel. I'm from Washington and Jane's from California.
We're very liberal.
I thought that. Anyway, I think we'll go to Barb next.
Okay. Well, I'm one of the Catholics here, and I'm going to talk about my church family. Back in the 1970s, I had a crisis of faith. There were many, many reasons for that. I was in my 20s. But part of it was that my church said women can't be called to the ministry. And another part was that in our church, the image of God was very narrow. God was Father, God was Almighty, and it really didn't go much further. And finally, a friend of mine said, I know the church for you, and she took us. As we walked in the church doors, there was a small instrumental combo up by the altar playing, walk right in, sit right down. And we did, and I thought, wow, I'm going to like this. And then shortly into the service, the pastor said, turn to your neighbors and greet them, and then tell your neighbor something wonderful about yourself. And in the first four Sundays we were there, the sermon was given by a Jewish rabbi, a Lutheran minister, a lay person, and finally, a Catholic priest. But what was even more remarkable to me anyway was the language. God was addressed as Father, but just as often, God was addressed as our mother. And I was just blown away. I signed it. And recently, St. Jones has added a greeting before the service starts. Each week, a member of the parish goes up to the altar just a minute before the service starts and tells what brought them originally to St. Joan of Arc and why they stay. And they end this greeting with the same phrase every week. We welcome you wherever you are on your journey. You know, how do these diverse pieces of the worship service relate to tonight's topic? Well, I'd like to answer that in part by an analogy. Jane was talking earlier this week about, you know, our intimate families as opposed to our church families. And she said, what do kids want? Kids want to know that they are loved for who they are. And I think what my church is trying to do is to say in multiple ways that God loves you for who you are and you belong here with us. I think that's a very powerful message. I think it matters. I think it bears repeating. As an example of that, one of my friends, Jan, is a Presbyterian. She's been going to St. Joan's for years. Her husband is Catholic. And she says it wasn't until she heard that phrase, we welcome you wherever you are on your journey, that she cried when she heard it, because she said for the first time she felt it didn't matter that she was different. Its message was saying to her, it's okay to be different. You belong here even so. And I'll end with one last example of how St. Joan's tries, how it struggles with this idea of diversity and celebrating our differences. If you here have young children, or if you've ever had young children, you know that many times you want to worship in a way that addresses adult concerns, but you also would like to worship with your children. And what St. John's has tried to do is do a little of both. The service starts with all the adults and teenagers in a room together called the big room, and the younger children go to their classrooms for Sunday school. And then after the sermon, the people with children join their children in another room for family service, where it doesn't matter whether you sit on the chair or you slide along on your stomach underneath the chairs. And the idea there is that families are worshiping together. The sermon is given by families and it addresses family concerns. And this is another way of saying to people in the parish, to parents and children, and I think coincidentally to the people who stay in the big room, you belong here, we welcome you wherever you are on your journey.
Well, when I look at the topic, I suppose one of the things I'm going to say more around families that we've been working on. I'm a single parent, and I have one child, and I've had a very hard time sometimes convincing myself that two people in that situation are a family. That we're either a satellite or slightly defective, waiting for completion. And that it would be easier if we were around our extended family because we have a frame. And I have one brother, his family's in the Midwest, our parents are in the East Coast, and now my daughter and I are in California. And I think when we talk about diversity, what I realize is that I failed to replicate on a continuing basis what I had growing up. And I didn't, the only person I ever knew that was in my situation, one mom, one daughter, and no father. We didn't know there really was no father until she got married and he wasn't there. But that was 19 years later. We thought he was on the longest assignment for Time Magazine overseas there had ever been. And so I realized that this was a little hard. I mean, even for me to feel all right and for Lucy too. So that's been one piece in thinking about how many people does it make to do family successfully. But the other one is because, I think, precisely because we're a small unit, my sense of the need for my extended family and the importance it is for my daughter to say there are these other people and how very hard this is at these great distances. That we go back for several weeks, which of course is pretty disruptive to my career in some ways, because you drop everything in the summer when you would supposedly publish, right? And the other thing is when your parents are in their late 70s and you come home with a four-year-old, 3.5 weeks of that nonstop is not easy for anybody. And yet, yet those are the circumstances that under which we need to do it, and as my mother said, they certainly weren't the ones in which she raised her children. You know, where the grandparents may have been in another state, but it was Pennsylvania, you know, it wasn't Oregon. So I thought a lot about how that sort of diversity that you really do have to form new kinds of bonds and how they work and how you nurture them. When I go home, as I said to my mother, you know what I like about coming here is I play make-believe. I make-believe I live in Glen Burnie, you know, from there, and that I meet, and we're going and doing our grocery shopping together and having lunch, and it's something we do every week. And that, you know, and that I can leave Lucy for a little while and go out with a friend and have more to drink than I ought to. Because it won't be embarrassing. It won't be, somebody will get her to bed.
Yeah.
And I could just stay with my friends and talk, you know. And I said, it hurts to let it go. Because it's not like that. And that is one place where my church sort of moves in. But one of the things, I want my daughter to remember her grandparents. I want that to be a part of who she is. And how do you do that when there are thousands of, you know, when you're on the opposite coast?
Yesterday at one of the Bible studies, we had some marvelous discussion around diversity that centered on saying that, I think I'll just wait for the truck to go by. It's okay.
Everybody wave.
Is it that truck?
It's that truck.
It's that truck.
It's that truck.
Every March is free. Let's go.
But it's not flowing.
Somebody had made a comment. I appreciate what you said about diversity town. About, but we've got this diversity. And what our discussion turned around is how what we perceive or don't perceive as diversity may be more a statement about our eyes than about our circumstances. And I think I can offer that to this panel because within minutes of your asking me and giving me the topic this morning, somebody else met me on the patio as my daughters walked by and said, you know, I would never say this to them, but they look like nesting dolls. Which is, I mean, precisely the reciprocal of what you were saying, the inability to see that these three blonde, blue-eyed Minnesota creatures are, in fact, quite diverse. And you know, I discovered it as soon as we had two children. I mean, even if I hadn't already been discovering that Anna was just going to be a completely different kind of character, one of her godmothers remarked at her baptism to Sue and me, said, you know, I really feel sorry for Anna. And, you know, she was 10 days old. I said, what? She said, do you realize that she is growing up with 3 firstborn children? I'm a firstborn, and my wife is a firstborn. And, of course, our firstborn couldn't help but be. You got to start somewhere. So there were 3 firstborn children, and then there's Anna. And your birth order doesn't define all of diversity. But it is one of the ways that we come to see and appreciate just what a unique person she is, and therefore all of us are. The quip I made at the party the other night was simply that I thought I had learned so much parenting the first baby, and then got the second one and realized none of it applied. And one day, this just happened a couple of months ago, and it was our monthly board meeting night, so I have about 20 minutes for supper. But I live in a fairly small town, so I could zip home, and I was wolfing down this food, and Sarah said,
just like Holden.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Sarah said, man, you eat fast. And I said, well, I'm hungry. I said, just wait till you're working for a living. She said, well, we work for a living. And Anna, who again is the second born, said, I'm living for a living. Which is, you know, something that 3 firstborns stood around and went. It had never occurred to us. I'd never seen it that way. It's a statement about eyes. I think the more poignant experience that we have had, I mean, the symmetry of our families is just, it defies description. Brace yourselves for this. My brother, my only brother, is married to my wife's sister. And they have 3 boys who look just like our 3 girls. The oldest two, this is the kind of comment, I mean, I wish we could stop the tape, you know, like, what did you say? What did
you say? The Brady Bunch.
It's too funny. You know? Anyway, when Bruce and Nancy called to tell us that they were expecting, and in May, we should about die because we were expecting, and in May, but hadn't told anybody yet, you know? And then when our friends started to find out about this, they said, do you guys do everything together? No, not at all. Well, anyway, there are these 3 boys who are, you know, look just as much alike, but again, are just as different. 3 girls, just as much unique individuals, particularly because the 3rd nephew was born a year to the day after Inga was born. They share a birthday, March 13th. Was born multiply handicapped with a herniated diaphragm and spina bifida. The day of his birth, he was given a 1 in 5 chance to live. And it is the most poignant experience in tragedy and joy in our lives, and how to hold on to both of them. Because it was, on the other hand, Inga's birthday. And she was alive. And that's worthy of celebration no matter what else happens. But I work with grieving parents and knew what March 13th would always mean if Nicholas didn't live. Nicholas lived, and Nicholas is doing well. For that we are eternally grateful. But then there was all of the questions about how we claim who we are while accepting who he is. And one of the reasons we come to Holden is because we love to hike. Now that not only Nicholas may not be able to hike, but the whole family really can't hike because he can't walk. And to try to work through all of those pieces of how Nicholas is not less paralyzed if I refuse to use my legs, you know? And make peace then with those diversities that are, as you said, Jane, part of the extended family, which is, as I've already acknowledged, hopelessly enmeshed. So those are my pieces.
Thank you. This has been wonderful. A question about what we mean by diversity and how that gets addressed anywhere when we're talking in our families or whatever, and how we view them or not view them. How our church communities at their best can welcome many people. How we define, that's Eugene, how we define what family is. What do we mean? What is it? How do we do it where we are? Do we have to make believe, like Jean does when she goes home? Or when we look like we have the perfect Minnesota family, all that is distinct about that, and both in suffering and joy. So we welcome your stories, your comments, your responses. Jim.
I come from a situation, I guess I should stand up, or kind of getting back here, where a lot of people have to have families of choice. In the gay and lesbian community, so many people have been rejected by their parents and siblings, and so they have had to develop families of choice. And many times the church provides that kind of function where people can make connections and really celebrate holidays together and things like that. The other thing that's, of course, very much a factor is that we've had a lot of death in those families of choice where people have been friends and gotten together for holidays and things like this for years and years, and suddenly, why there are all these people missing? And that's all happened over a period of 10 years. So it just kind of, that's one of the things we deal with. The other thing is that with families of choice, we have a lot of elderly people in our city who used to travel to see, and these are very often women who never had children, and used to travel to see nieces and nephews and spend that way, but now they can't travel anymore. They're because of age or things like this, or you know, it's just too much of an effort, and so they have had to find families of choice. So we do talk a lot about in our context about families of choice rather than biological families. Those are important to lift up, and we really get very angry when we hear some of this rhetoric about who is a family, and it's a mom and a dad and a couple of kids and a dog and a cat and three goldfish. That's what James Dobson and Focus on the Family, some of that rhetoric is really offensive.
I know, I'd like to add one thing to Jim's comment, if I could. About years ago, I learned to use the word household instead of family, and try to share that often. And when I talk about the congregation I serve, and somebody asks, what's it like? I say, we have every possible household is represented there. And then they can just decide what that is. But it's true, it's just about, and it's another interesting way to construct that and think of that in this whole context. What else? Yeah.
Holden has a way of, whenever you say something, there are so many great minds out there turning things around, and so I hope people turn it around. But when Jane was talking, I was thinking about what sounded like perhaps hope in there, but there was a built-in fear or anxiety about being disconnected from your family and your daughter from you. That part of that had to do with not being that nucleus family, in a sense. And I'm just wondering how much diversity and differences scare us. That as something's different from us, we get disconnected. I mean, we get disconnected because our kids aren't us. Somebody doesn't believe what we believe. And we get scared. We get scared about being disconnected, lost. Parents are East. What happens if something happens to your daughter? You know, now you're in California. do I move, and now I'm disconnected from my job. And so you can't, you have to kind of hold something off in order to feel protected somehow. And so sometimes you have to push the job to get back to the family. And I guess those kinds of alienation feelings are just always going to be with us, and we have to make some things different in order to feel same to something else. I mean, maybe it's just the way we live. I don't know.
No, I was struck at the time that Lucy's father and I parted ways. She was very young. I did have to go home for a while because I had no place to live. And it was quite clear around any number in the circle here that I would move back. That's what I would end up doing, because actually people who went belly up in their marriages, that's what they did. They sort of came home as a dependent. And I remember thinking, well, no, I got tenure. I mean, they may not like the look of me, but they're stuck.
But also, what you're married to.
Yeah, but also sitting there and thinking, oh, but I mean, an assumption, I thought, oh, I must relieve my parents of this quickly. But also thinking, well, no, we'll go on. We're not going on the way I thought we would go on. And what I'm realizing is that who they are and how we've connected is going to make it, it's part of what's making it possible to go on. But I think you're quite right. I mean, you make choices, and the choice in my family has always been, you know, you need to do what makes you happy and is fulfilling. I mean, my father's first comment on this, he said, you and Lucy have a fine future together. And what we're about now is fighting to make it safe. Mm-hmm. Right? And retreating wasn't going to do that. Right? So I realized there's another way, which, I mean, that says something about the kind of bond. Sometimes, I mean, the funny thing is I want more contact with them because they're the ones that let me know that I have been let go. Do you know that funny thing? It's like, yeah, you know, you can do it. And we're the first ones to see it. And so I think it's that that kind. And the other thing I thought a lot about intimacy, you know, about how do you build that? How do you, and how much of it is that day by day kind of goofy stuff. It isn't, you know, I mean, it isn't the big moment with the heart-shaped bed and the hot tub on the, you know, on the weekend away in Vegas, but loading the dishwasher and sorting out this kind of, and that, I think it's that piece sometimes I really miss, you know, I mean, those sort of rhythms that let pieces of you come out. I mean, my mother and I had the best conversations we ever had when we were setting up our new house in Minnesota, you know, put a little shelf paper down, tell it like it is. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what I think is quite what you were saying about families of choice is creating those kinds of comfortable situations that can happen. And I have to say, one of the things I've loved about being in California is I have a church that's, people are onto that. They've been where I've been. I mean, one night I was ill and I wasn't going, so people invited me out, I wasn't going out. These women showed up at my door, said, our husbands are sitting, Lucy, Jane, out of your jammies. They took Lucy, she's going here, we're taking you with us. And they said, because we know that's what you need. Even though you don't, you need, and what I realized is, sometimes you just need somebody to move in and take care of you a little bit. And it was lovely. You know, it was, so I think you're right. It's always that balance.
It's balanced in one respect, but it's also a curious sense of being drawn to paradox almost. We hold another kind of interesting connection here. I knew she was talking about Saint Joan of Arc 30 seconds into it. I've been there. My wife has been with Saint Joan of Arc. And it strikes me that I go there, I don't go there every Sunday, but I go there kind of
even not periodically. I go there when I need a dose of something, and it's a dose of and here's the paradox. It's a dose of intimacy, precisely based on the diversity, which is the paradox, because you think of diversity as being splitting apart and somehow, you know, imbalanced and whatnot. But you walk in there, and there ain't nobody like you. And yet there everybody is like you. And they celebrate that in such a way that I leave and I go, wow, I got that, you know, or I can do my stuff for a while. And then you kind of, something happens and you say, I got to go back to St. Joan's for another, right? Yeah. But it's not because everybody is like me. It is precisely that kind of intimacy drawn out. And I don't know the answer. I'm just simply putting two ideas which seem to be kind of relatively paradoxical. But it's the juxtaposition of those ideas that for me is very powerful. And it stems from much of what you said. I raised a son and a daughter to a great degree by myself, and had that sense of disconnect. First divorce in a family ever. We couldn't find anybody else who was ever kind of divorced. So I was kind of off the edge completely.
You were first born?
Yeah, I was second born. Absolutely, I mean, his daughter and I are right there. Absolutely. Right. We land up being professors in universities, by the way.
That's
right.
Fine.
Yeah. Real life doesn't make real sense. but it is, it's, and so I guess the survival is based on being able to find, doesn't have to be a parish necessarily, like St. Joan, which is just kind of a jewel by itself. But there are other places in which we get it. But once again, it's reconciling that notion of being different, seeking some pattern of community out of that, and then using that as a way to sustain your difference, not to somehow reduce it or shave it off or make those bumps maybe kind of go away. I remember, just a little quick story, I think the very first time I ever went to St. John's, and I remember it because my daughter, and my daughter and my son, who I was raising, we were living pretty much by ourselves, and my daughter was, I don't even recall, maybe 11 years old, 12 years old, and she had just had her period the week before that. Okay. So here I am, this was the first daughter in 11 births. I have a brother myself. I don't even know what, you know, little girls are like. And here she and I and my son, who's 2 years older than her, had this wonderful celebration about this kind of transformation that this daughter of mine went through, which I had no idea, conceptually, but I'd never participated, you know? And it was really, it was on one respect, a great celebration to say, wow, to really be there with her and try to understand this. And on the other side to say, I'll never understand it. You know, she's teaching me, and she's bringing me along, and kind of doing it in a very joyous type of way. So that's
stupid. Yes, sir.
But don't say anything about that to her friends, because that would embarrass her terribly.
Oh, I've made that mistake more than once. I didn't say I got it right. I simply say I made it through.
Well, not quite. Surely there are other stories about families. Yeah, go ahead.
I probably read a book myself about being Asian and coming to America for, in the times when it wasn't necessarily a tossed-out like community, but it's too depressing, so I'm not going to get into that. But what I want to say is, taking what Bill said about there's a lot of fear, I think, among people when they see somebody different from you. And so what I'm suggesting is a change of attitudes when we see people that are different from us, to see what richness there is in the difference, rather than fearing the differences, because as human beings, we're all human, that's our commonality. And so if we could just say there is richness in these differences among us, let's find those differences and celebrate them, rather than dwell on the fear, that we could all enjoy each other better, because we have, as time goes, to live in more and more diverse races, diverse conditions.
I think that's what I'm saying. It's doubly hard, which is part of what Bill's getting at, when it's in the confines of your own household. When somebody in your own household maybe is radically different than you, you know. But it's the fear, I think, goes. Yeah.
My youngest child is just that critter. He is as opposite from me as night is day, and that has been my learning curve that he presents me. I think in many ways I've done the best job with him. He has the best esteem, but that esteem is what's given him the ability to say to me, "Mom, quit trying to change me. I am who I am." And I'm going, "Whoop, he's right." You know, he is very myopic in his thing. I'm very grandiose. He's very introvert. I'm very extrovert. Just as opposite. And so my challenge is to learn to honor that and just love him for who he is and provide him opportunities. And there he is. And he's in his doing his thing. and it's my challenge.
I think it's hard, too, when you have someone in your family who's so different. My family has three readers and one radio listener. And it's just so hard for me to understand someone who doesn't like to read. I have to work at it. And you do, and at some point you have to tell yourself, I'm never going to understand this. But I still love this person. And you have to work at it every day.
Yeah.
For me, there's quite a lot of diversity within my family. And I, for some reason, was reminded of conversations that I've had with my older brother. I'm an openly gay man. And my older brother was involved in some pretty fundamentalist charismatic movements for a while. So he and I had some disagreements. that led to many, many hours of conversation and argument. And there was one time when he drove to Milwaukee to visit with me for a while, and I knew something was up because he had never come to visit before. And we had all of our Bibles lined up. We started at about 3 in the afternoon and went until about 2 o'clock that night. And there were, on more than one occasion, where I thought, why am I letting this person talk to me like this? Why am I not just kicking this person out of my house? And then it would sort of be a shock. This is my brother. You know, we're conversing, and the sort of this strange dynamic of something that kept us bonded and kept us there grinding with one another, talking about an issue that we weren't finding much common ground on at all, and so that's. I think about that bond of family that sometimes I don't often feel, and other times I'm just overwhelmed with that thought of, like, these are people that are going to be around for the rest of my life. I mean, my friends, I have friends that I think will be around for the rest of my life too, but that my sister reminds me, you know, friends will come and go, but you're stuck with family forever, so you better work through issues that are there. And that's both a comfort, and sometimes it really scares the it's a great challenge. But to agree to disagree and to find common ground, because that was the other point that I wanted to make, that sort of the black sheep of the family, I'm the only one that had gone on to college and pursued a different type of career in social work and social justice, often found it difficult to find common meeting grounds with my families to communicate. If I want to get together with friends and I'm not living at Holden, it's like, well, let's go out for dinner, let's go out for coffee. And my brothers, who are into stock car racing and you know, different sorts of recreation. You know, for me to suggest going out, and I did this once with my younger brother. I said, we should get together when I come home. He goes, yeah. And I said, well, maybe we could go out for dinner. He said, oh, great. Then we'll stop and have cocktails. And his, you know, he's like, let's just go get a beer.
Yeah.
So I've learned to sort of adjust, you know, if I want to make these connections, realizing that it's a two-way street, that when I go to visit my brothers, I go with maybe a six-pack if I decide to have a beer. But I go with the anticipation of going down in the garage and helping them work on their latest car that they pulled up. And with my sisters, it's probably going to be out in the garden, you know, something outside. So for a long time, I sort of I had this stubborn ground where I thought, no, they need to talk to me about what I'm learning in college and my latest works with the homeless. And it became a very lonely spot.
Yeah.
And so we'd sit there quiet a lot, you know, waiting to ask and then waiting to, I don't know. So those are just some interesting lessons that I've learned with my family that I thought I'd share.
I'd like to share. I'm a member of Sierra Club. My son is a lumber worker.
What are you talking about?
His trolls. Trucker, really.
You can choose your friends, but not your relatives.
Go ahead.
I have Korean twins that we adopted before we had our two biological children, and we wanted them really bad, and they came, and I had never really thought of them as being really that different. And I always remember, I think we had them maybe a week or two, and I was in the bathroom and kind of using the mirror, and I looked in the sink and I saw this black hair, and I thought, whose hair is that? Because I never really thought of them as being different, but of course they did have black hair.
That makes me think of two households I know who also adopted. They have big Korean children who were not infants, but were 3 and 7 years old. Two different, one was 3, one was 7. And both of those households got into, when they got into adolescence, of needing to try to find out from this child what had happened to them. You know, with great sorrow and huge, huge struggles about the deep love for this child that they had amalgamated or tried to, you know, into their family. And then all of a sudden there is a gigantic cultural and history difference that cannot be traced, you know, can't be found out, and is so painful, and in one case so extreme, it led the person up in some severe criminal issues and said that, that it was, you know, just, it's the kind of situation we're talking about here where the diversity becomes unlooked for and more painful than can almost be borne with thought. That's the other side that made me think of those two stories.
Well, I think because my twins always had each other, there was just kind of that unspoken bond.
Yeah.
They're boy, girl, and they don't really express themselves. Right? They're 22 years old now.
Right.
But just that unspoken bond.
Yeah.
And they knew they were abandoned the day they were born, so there hasn't been any.
That's wonderful.
Hopefully, they'll go back someday and see the country and see theirs.
What else?
I have a question for Paul. How do your daughters deal with their cousin, with a group of cousins, especially the last one? If you wouldn't mind, I would just be curious.
I think with the eyes of children would be the best. If they're very candid about what Nicholas can do and can't do. Nicholas is too. He's pretty articulate about that for a kindergartner. He'll go to first grade this year. I think that that may get more awkward yet as the disparity between what they can do gets wider. And is probably the hardest on Inga. Inga is our youngest, because the older four go off. And she feels torn. She doesn't want to leave Nicholas alone, but doesn't want to be left by the older kids either. And I don't know, I wish my kids were here, if you could ask them. But if they'd been here, I couldn't have said everything else I said. So.
Yeah. We're
all around the corner.
Just outside.
Yeah, right. I'll pay for this.
Right. What else? Other stories or comments? Yes.
Well, I see a lot of older than myself, right here, all people in the audience, and I guess, or in the discussion, and things were going along pretty well for me, and I had like two launched in college, and one that was hitting high school, and then things started getting really sort of rocky. The youngest went to more of a rebel stage, and I'm finding this in-between stage, even with my daughter who just graduated from college and sailed to, has come back home, I'm finding this much, much more difficult than I ever expected.
Mm-hmm. You mean how they've come back? She's graduated and they're back home living now.
It's not that. It's that question of differences and then moving into adulthood.
Yeah. I think you get it, at least one thing I've observed in that is that also about people with kids are getting ready to, you know, be around college age. It was funny because I was working with a group of parents. I mean, I was a member of this group, and the woman who was running it had a daughter who was college age, and she would talk sometimes, and you'd think,
boy, if she feels this way about her kid, what's the point of taking this class?
That's why, you know? But I remember one time we talked, and she said, you know, a sign in a way that the process is unfolding the way it's supposed to is that really there comes a point where they just take up too much damn room. And I thought that was interesting. She said, both physically and psychically. And it's time for them to go. And that one of the problems in the way the economy and certain things are working now, that at least our patterns have been, you graduate, you make it a brief nest return, then you're out again to try, that these things do not have to happen in the presence of each other. And it's healthier because you can't help but get drawn in. You're not supposed to, they resent it, but they also, you know, it's like, well, how can you be so indifferent? And I think her description of that was quite right, that this unfolding suddenly means that it's just too much space, and it's hard for you to make the very transitions you need to make into what's a different part of your life. Because you say it seems to be neither this nor that, you know, they aren't done, they aren't on, and I think for a lot of people, we're not sure what is the definition of parental responsibility there. See, and we don't know the way, we do have an idea what we're supposed to do with them in junior high and such. Well, I mean, I think we have some sense. There's at least a lot of wisdom. So I don't know if you feel better to say that for you to say this is very hard, it makes a great deal of sense.
One comment that I would make is, you know, it sort of brought them up to honor diversity or whatever and to go their own way. And one of the things that I found is that they choose to join the mainstream. You know, it's not like I'm urging them to be mainstream, but, you know, my daughter is probably the easiest although we've had some, and she's the oldest, but maybe because we're firstborns too. Somebody told me, you know, it was the youngest. None of us were thirds. We didn't know what to do. But we've had discussions about sororities and things like that that have been really, but there is a tendency of, I was looking around the number of kids at camp that are smoking. I'm working as a maverick. I'm working with the young guys. And one of the things that blows me away is the fact that my two sons both started smoking, the 17-year-old and the 21-year-old. And this is, my parents had smoked and quit for good reason. The other side of the family, nobody had smoked for two generations. I can't believe the number of kids out there that are smoking. So I guess I'm more accepting of it right now, watching all these kids out there that are doing it. You know, good kids are smoking. But some of it's values things, and some of it's, I mean, it's just.
There's another hand back here.
Right. I was going to say, there's a sad bit of wisdom. You're a parent forever. There's no, really no ending to it. You know, you think you have it settled, and there you are. You know, you're still a parent. It's just there. And I sort of think of, like, poor God. He's parent to all of us, and he's our parent forever.
We're emptiness syndrome.
You know, I've just got these three, but you know, there are some things you can't get away from, and you never get away from being a parent. And then you have the grandkids, and you know, mm-hmm. a little bit of parenting has to come out again, you know. But it's there.
Do we have any grandparents raising grandchildren here? Huh? No, I mean, that's actually fairly common. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A couple of those in my congregation. Bill, you had something, and then behind you, yeah.
Well, I was just,
yeah.
The issues of communication, you know, in all these discussions are always so paramount. And the images I often have in dealing with deaf members of families is that they never even approach these levels of communication. Mm. They're just so elementary. Mm. The image that's strongest is when I was dean of students at the School for the Deaf in Philadelphia, and I would suspend kids left and right, and the parents would come. And I would interpret everything for the parents. And it's just dumbfounded. You know, there could never be a conversation about sexuality. You know? And it's a different level, it seems. It would be nice to be able to engage in all those struggles, I suppose. So there's a blessing in being at that level, and maybe not, you know, maybe.
And right behind Bill, yeah.
What's interesting, you were asking if there was anybody raising grandparents. I mean, our grandchild is raising us, let's put it that way. I mean, we aren't raising him, but what we have found that's been kind of frustrating is that the rules have all changed. Mm-hmm. Since we were raising our kids, you know, what we did in our manners of discipline and what we thought was, you know, positive image kinds of things, you know, now we are getting a lot of feedback from the parents of this little guy, you know, that this isn't the way you do it anymore. So we're having to relearn a lot of these skills in order to be, you know, grandparents and the kind of grandparents they want.
We have one more. There was one more person back here, I think, that wanted to, with glasses back there. Did you have your hand?
You had your hand.
Oh, I just wanted to mention that the unfolding of the wings, is that, were you talking to me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was pointing at you for the benefit of the interpreters.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry.
The unfolding of the wings, there's the, you know, you one child will do it, and so rapidly that you're, you know, you're not quite up emotionally with what's going on. And then another child, you actually have to physically kick them out repeatedly. And other members have to do the same thing. It's a terrible process. But you ask yourself as a parent what went wrong, the same methods were used. Why is the diversity so great? And you have to let go of it. Simply have to let it go. Mm-hmm.
It's 9:30 right now. Sally, one quick comment, then we can end it.
But aren't you more glad that they would come back than that they would never want to come to you again for anything? I see children who will never go to their parents for anything.
You have to tell them you love them no matter what. Yeah. You know, it doesn't matter what's happened. You know, you have to tell them. And especially when they're not very emotional, you know, it's very important to say it. But I don't know any other great secret. I have none.
Okay, we'll do. This is good right this moment. So right now, Luther.
I don't think you have to let them come back and live at home in order to be a good parent.
Right. You can still, just as the person behind you said, I love you when you live there. Right. And
there.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And some parents might choose to help pay the rent, mm-hmm. pay first and last month's rent, save up a little bit of money for a while to help them move on. But I think a lot of parents get really damaged when they have children come back as adults and live in the home. Yeah. And they feel a lot of guilt in not allowing the child to live at home. But I think it's unhealthy in many cases to have them at home.
Well, on that note, let's one more comment. Okay, go ahead. Chris, come on, go ahead.
Well, interestingly, I mean, I have my kids in all different places. One hasn't really been home since he graduated from high school, the 17-year-old can't wait till he's 18, and the daughter has just come home and plans to live in with for a few months. And I had some really ambivalent feelings about coming home. I mean, she's doing fine, and there are all these things, but you know, I need some boundaries. But I also talked to a friend who said, you know, in our culture, we separate everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, we send our kids off to nursing school. We put our elders in our nursing homes. She said, you know, I lived in a home with my grandmother, and every night that I came home from a dance, she would be awake and she'd say something to her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a culture and a world, we don't do that. So it sort of got me looking at it from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. There are no easy answers. I mean, I need boundaries with, I mean, she's an oldest boy, do I need boundaries with her? But, you know, it's, part of me says you need your own space, and I want her to take it, you know, soon. But, I mean, there are all sorts of things going on. But it did make me think twice, like, don't be too fast about saying you need to find your own place. Mm-hmm. You
know, So that's a nice way to think about how we celebrate and suffer both things. Thank you for that.